From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
When there's our sacred land where we offer, pray, do the offering to the Mother Earth and to the trees and to the mountains, to the spring, to the rocks, to the...
Navajo and Hopi elders stage a prayer vigil at the annual shareholders meeting of Lehman Brothers to protest coal mining on Native lands.
I am from Hopi Nation. We have come here to talk to Peabody Mine Company about coal and water.
And Father Michael Lapsley, an ANC priest who lost his hands and eye to an apartheid letter bomb, talks about armed struggle, genocide, and reconciliation in South Africa. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Tensions with China are continuing to escalate over a U.S. spy plane which collided with a Chinese fighter jet 3 days ago and then made an emergency landing at a Chinese military base. The Chinese jet fell into the sea and the pilot's missing. Chinese President Jiang Zemin, in his first public comments on the incident, said today that the U.S. should accept full responsibility for the collision and halt all surveillance flights near China's coast. He made no mention of the fate of the crew members. President Bush yesterday demanded immediate U.S. access to the 24 crew members and the return of the top-secret aircraft, which are being held on the island of Hainan. Today, the United States ambassador to China said he believed Chinese officials had been, quote, all over the plane. Criminal investigations against Slobodan Milosevic widened yesterday, with police charging the former Yugoslav president with inciting his guards to shoot at officers sent to arrest him for alleged corruption and abuse of power. Ever defiant, Milosevic demanded to be released in an appeal filed from his cell in Belgrade Central Prison, calling his arrest politically staged. Milosevic was arrested early Sunday following a 26-hour standoff with police. If tried and convicted on all the Yugoslav charges pending against him, Milosevic would face 5 to 15 years in prison. Answering accusations that he illegally channeled millions of dollars to secret funds, Milosevic said yesterday the money went to the Bosnian and Croatian Serb armies, which unsuccessfully fought to prevent Bosnia and Croatia from leaving Yugoslavia. It was the first time Milosevic had publicly admitted financing the wars in Bosnia and Croatia. He also said the cash went to Serbian security troops and, quote, anti-terrorist forces, and that the funds were intended to circumvent the international embargo against Yugoslavia. The United States and other Western governments have pressured Belgrade to extradite Milosevic. At stake is $50 million in U.S. aid, money that Washington had withheld until it determined that Yugoslavia was serious about cooperating with the tribunal. Yesterday, the State Department said the cash would be released now that Milosevic is behind bars, although Secretary of State Colin Powell said future assistance hinged on cooperation with the U.N. court. And several hundred activists in Ottawa yesterday attempted to liberate the free trade area of the Americas negotiating documents. The FTAA would expand NAFTA to the entire Western Hemisphere, creating the largest free market zone in the world. It would affect 650 million people and an estimated $9 trillion in capital, and is expected to expand the scope of NAFTA's free trade agenda to cover the service sector. The U.S. government has been negotiating the FTAA with selected corporations in 34 countries of the Americas since 1994, but has never allowed citizens to see the documents. We turn now to Carrie Pither in Ottawa to find out how many people were arrested and what happened after we left her and the other activists outside the trade building yesterday in Ottawa. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Carrie.
Morning.
So how many people were arrested?
In total, I'm now told 87 people were arrested, but last night all were released without charge except three who've decided to withhold their names.
Mm-hmm. You were outside the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade building where the FTAA documents are held. Were you able to, as you say, liberate them?
Well, those 87 people did try to go into the building. Ironically, once arrested, they were dragged into the building by the police and then taken off to the police station to be processed. So, no, we didn't liberate the text, but I think we liberated the corporate media quite a bit because they ended up talking a lot yesterday about what we were doing and about the secrecy surrounding the text.
And the text that you want to see, its significance?
Yes. Yes, we wanted to see the negotiating text of the FTA.
Right, and what is its significance?
Why is it significant? We believe that if we could see it, that there could be an informed public debate in Canada about what is actually at stake with the FTA that's being proposed. And for us, that's issues, of course, around healthcare, education, and democracy itself, the environment, et cetera.
Well, Carrie Pither, I want to thank you for being with us. Carrie Pither is one of the organizers of the anti-FTAA, that's a free trade area of the agreement of the Americas, Summit of the Americas, that's going to be taking place in Quebec City on April 18th, 19th, 20th. You're listening to Democracy Now! Nero singing Broken Rainbow here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Yesterday, elders from the Diné, Hopi, and Lakota nations came to Manhattan and staged a prayer vigil at a Lehman Brothers annual shareholders meeting. Lehman Brothers manages an investment fund that is the major owner of Peabody Coal. Peabody is mining on and near Native lands in the Southwest, particularly Arizona. The dislocation of Native Americans and destruction of their lands to serve the energy needs of an extravagant society is nothing new. In the 1970s, when the country was undergoing yet another energy shortage, President Carter declared that the Four Corners area of the American Southwest was a national sacrifice area. Last year, the Hopi joined the Diné or Navajo Nation in a federal lawsuit. It alleged that Peabody Coal engaged in a conspiracy with the Department of Interior to defraud the tribes and prevent the fair payment of coal royalties to the tribes. The Black Mesa area has perhaps the largest coal deposit in the United States. But in addition to financial concerns are issues of relocation, environmental degradation, and respect for Native American people, traditions, and land. 16 years ago, I went out to the Navajo and Hopi land, the reservation of Arizona, and had a chance to speak with some of the Navajo elders and others, as well as the Hopi. And this is how some of them, Betty Tso, a young woman, and Roberta Blackoat, much older, talked about the significance of the land.
Well, it's our sacred land where we offer, pray, do the offering to the Mother Earth and to the trees and to the mountains, to the spring, to the rocks, to the prairies.
We all make our living off of our livestock. And our livestock is a security to us. Like you have your money in your bank, you know, that's your something to fall back on. And to us, our livestock is like that. No, and even if we don't have jobs or anything like that, that is our way of making a living. And that's our survival.
Then, in Arizona, two Navajo women whose lives revolve around the Indian reservation. They fear the loss of that which is most sacred to them, the land, the sheep, and passing these on to the next generation.
The land is my home. It's where I grew up. It's where I live all my life. I have a place to go when I'm sad. I have a place to be when I'm happy. I have, you know, I just know which way to go. I know the land like the back hand of my hand.
Betty Tso and Roberta Black Goat, many years ago, in 1985, the Navajo and Hopi land of Arizona, talking about the significance of their land. And again, yesterday, Roberta Black Goat and other elders came to New York to protest outside of Lehman Brothers, which manages an investment fund that's a major owner of Peabody Coal. Among those who spoke was a man who did not want to be identified simply as a Hopi resistor.
I am from Hopi Nation. We have come here to talk to Peabody Mine Company about coal and water. Traditional and priesthood people don't want this mining. The Hopi prophecies say that we have to protect land and life. And if we don't protect our beautiful earth, our heaven, our mother, we will suffer with her. All over the country, water will be contaminated and the air will be polluted. Living creatures will die from poisons left by industry. Peabody is also depleting our precious water resources. This is what Peabody is doing to the land in Arizona. We Hopi are a sovereign nation. We have never signed a treaty with the United States government or with any government. Yet the United States government did not see this and created the so-called Hopi Tribal Council. The United States government said that if 30% of the Hopi people vote to elect the Tribal Council, this will be legitimate council. But this did not happen. Less than 30% of the Hopi people voted, and some of the voters were not even Hopis. Furthermore, John Boyden was a lawyer who worked for Peabody Coal. He was instrumental to the creation of the Hopi Tribal Council. He was biased and not an impartial advocate for the Hopi people. Our ancestors fought against the creation of the Hopi Tribal Council, which was not representative of the Hopi people. But the United States government did not listen. Our ancestors warned that someday this would happen. White men will say that it is our own people that sold this land. I will not accept this. Because the Hopi tribe was created by the United States government, they followed the white man's constitution and bylaws instead of the Hopi laws and constitution. I am glad that our ancestors never signed any treaty with any government. So it is today, when we speak to you, layman brothers, even though we are just a few here, we speak for the Creator, who is the majority. Therefore, we demand you to stop the Peabody coal mining and the slurry. We demand again, stop the coal mining and the slurry. I pray for you and hope that we open your eyes and you find that majority in your heart. These are the voices from our ancestors. Our ancestors prophesied that this would happen. Now we are repeating this prophecy from the beginning to the end. Thank you. Hopi from Hopi Nation. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank.
And that was a Hopi resistor speaking outside of Lehman Brothers at the World Trade Center in New York yesterday. We invited Lehman Brothers to join us. This was outside of their annual shareholders meeting yesterday, but they declined our invitation. We're joined in the studio by those Navajo, Hopi, and Lakota who have been fighting Peabody Coal, as well as their supporters, including Arlene Hamilton, who's coordinator of Weaving for Freedom and a human rights defender at Big Mountain in Arizona. Tell us about this challenge that has been brought off the Navajo and Hopi land to the World Financial District in New York.
Well, it started in 1994 in terms of our efforts. For the last 32 years, they've been standing up against mining, but we took it to London, Roberta Blackout, Key Watcham, and myself to speak to the over 3,000 shareholders in London, right in the beast of the belly, the British Empire. And Roberta won the hearts of the shareholders. They made the executives of Peabody Coal made promises to preserve the land, replace the water, improve the living, you know, the quality of living, provide solar power, and to demilitarize the area. 2 years later, we went back because they didn't keep any of their promises. They gave us drops of water for 2.5 months. The people got clean drinking water, and we had been asking for many water wells to be opened. In 1996, Roberta went back to Lord Hanson Corporation and told him she was still looking for his word. Where was his word? And they didn't keep any of their promises. Things have escalated and gotten worse out there, very dehumanizing situation, and there's no running water, electricity. They're still trying to maintain their traditional lives, but they do still have their ceremonial life, language, sacred land, and culture intact because they have not allowed the mining to occur in the area. Because the suffering is so intense, and this was a harsh winter, and the summers are getting hotter, it's not only to protect the area that Roberta and the people decided to go back to Lehman Brothers, but to also stop global warming. So yesterday we went to Lehman Brothers to say that we are asking for the area to be preserved as a National Historic Culture Preservation Site and stop the suffering. Today actually is the shareholders meeting. Yesterday, Lehman Brothers had us all come in as a delegation of 17 Native American leaders throughout the country and met with us to set up how the shareholders meeting is going to go today. Last week, they weren't going to meet with us, but because of all the public pressure, Amy, they met with us yesterday. They're allowing all 17 Indigenous people in the meeting without shares, providing chairs and speaking time. However, we want a long-term plan here. We're here for water, solar power, all the human rights and religious freedom rights that have been violated, and to not have ceremonies surrounded by guns anymore. So you can turn to Roberta.
Roberta Blackout, it's, I have to say, remarkable to see you in the studios today, having been with you on your land, in your home, in 1985, when you were facing forced relocation by the U.S. government. Now you are taking on the Peabody Coal Company. And it takes a lot for you to make a trip like this halfway across the country.
Oh, yes. Well, my name is Roberta Blackout. And I've been traveling for all my nationwide in this, the whole country. Because in our traditional way, we had a big prayers for this, the whole country, just like a home. It's a home for all the nationwide here in this planet. So in that way, I've got a feeling that how way, way down the beginning, how the Creator, the Great Spirit from above, had set us with different tongue in different language into a certain part with their prayers to be a caretaker. In that way, we've been put the place where we are. He had surveyed it between the four sacred mountains. And this is going to be a home and have the Dene Nation to live inside. And then we can use a hogan. This has been called, a hogan. And then it turned to mountain. And so we had a prayers for each one of these mountain. Mountain Blanca and Mountain Taylor and San Francisco Peak and Mountain Herpes. And this is the four direction and four sacred mountain that we have with they're sitting with prayers and they're sitting with the sacred song. So inside is a room, and as I call, it's a church room. And right on the west side by San Francisco Peak is our altar right inside between the four two canyons. That's the water that has to be used. So there, this is the holy water.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. Robert Blackout, 85 years old, one of the Navajo elders, one of the leaders of the Sovereign Diné Nation. When we come back, we'll also be joined by Chief Joseph Chasing Horse, Sundance Chief from the Lakota Nation, and Leonard Benally, whose home land sits on perhaps one of the largest coal reserves in the United States. We'll also go back 16 years and hear from Roberta Blackout's son, Danny Blackout, talking about the significance of Hogan, the home, and what happened to him and his people as his culture was taken away from him through the BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, schools, and other deculturalization processes. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Navajo, Hopi, and Lakota leaders as they have come to New York to be at the Lehman Brothers annual shareholders meeting today, yesterday, conducting a prayer vigil outside. And we heard one of the speeches outside just a few minutes ago. Our guests are Roberta Blackout, one of the Navajo elders. We're also joined by Chief Joseph Chasing Horse, Sundance Chief from Lakota Nation. In 1999, he got the buffalo protected in Yellowstone National Park after a 500-mile walk. Last year, you come now regularly to the Navajo and Hopi area of Arizona, to the reservation, to conduct prayer vigils. Last year, that prayer vigil in 1999 was surrounded by the FBI?
It was a Sundance ceremony. And first of all, I want to thank you for inviting us here to speak, and to all the listeners out there. My name is Tashunka Okua. And to begin to understand the struggle or the plight of the indigenous people here, there is much education that must take place in understanding the historical aspect of how we have come about to this day and age where we face this type of exploitation and mining of our lands. And yes, it's true that we have taken a 507-mile journey to the Yellowstone National Park, which is one of the largest wildlife refuge areas in this country, where we had worked with the Yellowstone Forest Service officials in bringing about educating the educated about the importance of the buffalo and the buffalo culture. There were 160 million buffalo that once roamed this land here that they called North America for the last few hundred years, but known for 10,000s of years as Unchima Ka Makoche Wakan in our language. And so at that time, when the buffalo culture was at its peak, there were perhaps over 100 million indigenous people that lived here less than 500 years ago. And now there's not even a little over a million of us left that still live here on reservations that were created.
And on the reservation where you conduct the Sundance ceremony, the Navajo Hopi Reservation, you're calling for the shift in what President Carter called the National Sacrifice Area to what?
To a cultural preservation area. Why is because, see, before the arrival, the invasion, there was already a culture and vast civilization that existed here way before the white man landed upon our shores. There is archaeological evidence, and now with technological equipment, we can produce evidence to that fact that there were already a great civilization that lived here in balance with the natural world, and there were sacred sites every 100 miles across North America in which indigenous people used and had access and use of these sacred sites as to perform their ceremonies and to do their gathering rites, their hunting rites, their fishing rites, all which were a great part of their culture and their way of life. And now we find ourselves being denied access and use of those sacred sites.
I'm looking at an article on the California Aggie from the University of California, Davis, where you, Leonard Benally, spoke. And it begins by saying, "A king's fortune of coal sleeps just beneath the surface of activist Leonard Benally's Black Mesa, Arizona homeland. He, along with fellow members of the Navajo tribe, do not live like kings today. And in fact, many of them have been displaced from their homes amid claims of government bullying and ecological destruction." It says many of them have been displaced from their homes amid claims of government bullying and ecological destruction. A nearly 4,000 square mile area in northern Arizona has become the epicenter of a controversial battle between tradition and expansion, one that has drawn the attention of the United Nations. Benally says the federal government is forcing out his tribe from his home, one that is being ruined by the local coal company, Peabody Western Coal Mining Company. "We are outcasts from our own history, our land," he says. You have been speaking all over this country, Leonard Benally. How close is the coal company to your home, and what exactly is it doing?
Well, what they're doing is they're mining, extracting the resource, which is the coal from the Black Mesa, and we live on top of Black Mesa, and then the area, Big Mountain, still the motherland. The whole Black Mesa is a motherland to the people here, and we are the people out there, traditional Diné people. Because I'd like to clarify one thing here, because, the word Navajo is just a given name for us. Because our ancestors, they called it themselves Diné. And then after, they gave a census number out there. And then after that, they were called here Navajos, Mm-hmm. And now to this day, the government knows, the people like that. And then it's not only us out there that are in struggle. We got, the brothers and sisters, our neighbors, the Hopis. They got a very unique culture too. And, there's only, very few of us left out there resisting. And this resisting, is born in the heart of the indigenous people. 500 years ago here, indigenous people used to be lords and masters of their own land here, which she called today America, you know. But now, there are still numerous out there, but poverty so serious, is, you know, out on the land, and especially where we live. And we don't only think about ourselves, we think about, you know, the whole humanity, and we think about our brothers and sisters, you know, throughout the indigenous world, all around the world, and especially for the people of Zapatistas, you know. This whole thing, you know, is in solidarity with them, because for us, you know, this whole thing came to us in the wind, came to me in the wind, it came to the people out there on the land. You know, from the south wind came, you know, it's time that indigenous people start, you know, talking out, speaking out. So I do that myself too, you know, like I taught, encourage these young people, indigenous people, to talk about what's right, what's theirs, and what they lost, and, you know, and everything. It's time that we took back the Western Hemisphere.
When I went out to your land 16 years ago, I had the chance to speak with Roberta Blackoat at her home and her son, Danny Blackoat. At the time, he was 33. I guess he must be about 49, 48 now. But he continues to teach the culture and talk about what he lost in the Bureau of Indian Affairs schools where he was forced to go. And I wanted to go back to a bit of that conversation with Danny Blackoat in 1985.
I was born on the Big Mountain area of Black Mesa. My mother was born and raised there, and her grandparents were living there long before the coming of the white man back in the 1600s. Anyway, when I was 6 years old, I was taken away to BIA school. I went 3 years at a place called Pinon Boarding School. I didn't like school at all. I ran away from there a few times and always brought back to the school. And I was punished for misbehaving. And we were punished for speaking our own language also. And it was a bad setup.
And you said you ran away a few times. What didn't you like about the school?
I miss home. That was the main thing. And school was pretty foreign to me. And I didn't like it there. I was lonely and angry at the people that were trying to indoctrinate me into a new kind of learning. That was 65, 66, and 67, in which they urged some Indian dances and some powwows and stuff like that, and arts and crafts. But before that, we didn't have any exposure to our own culture at all. They wouldn't even permit our own language to be spoken in the schools. As a result of that, we lost some of our language. And that's what I'm trying to do right now, is to teach Navajo again to those people that want to learn, even non-Indians, you know. And I teach that as an evening division class or an evening community schools. And that's what I do on Monday nights.
Navajo ceremonies take place in and around the Hogan.
Hogan is home. It just is. There's no way I could explain it. It has a lot of religious significance. It's a, you can see it right up there. It's a dome-like structure, a spherical in shape, a half sphere. And it's round. It signifies the life as it happens. It's cyclical in motion, and there's a lot of songs and prayers that goes into building a hogan and even living it day to day. That we hold the hogan as if it was our Mother Earth. It's made up of juniper logs. And then you patch up in between the juniper logs with juniper bark and mud, and then you put dirt on the outside, wet dirt, and pack it all around the top, and it makes it good insulation. It's cool in the summer and warm in the winter.
Was Danny Blackgoat speaking about restoring his culture. Roberta Blackgoat, as you listened to that last song, you were rocking with the rhythm. What does that song mean to you as you listen to your son speak and sing?
Well, he's enjoying what he had learned and making him walk like learning and making a step something, you know, getting an education, like going up on school, you know, by grades. That's have it in the mind for saying that song. He's enjoying if he promote to another class, and then that's where he's enjoying. So that's why enjoying song.
He's using it. That's the enjoying song, and, you know, Danny still comes out and hauls water and everything for his mother, so he still continues to help her in her traditional life.
Arlene Hamilton, as we wrap up this discussion, today the Lehman Brothers meeting is taking place in New York. In addition to taking on Peabody Coal, which is run by an investment fund, a major owner in Peabody Coal that is managed by Lehman Brothers. You're calling for the demilitarization of the area of Big Mountain.
This is the last tribal matriarch of Native American indigenous women in America within the U.S. borders that still live the traditional way. We're calling for Lehman Brothers to preserve the entire area as a National Historic Culture Preservation Site. We are not here just to have a nice, friendly visit and be real sweet and kind to them, although we are taking the kind and nonviolent, you know, very, very serious approach. But we're trying to change corporate relations with indigenous people to have all of these sacred areas throughout the world be protected. And Peabody Coal Company has lied, and we're saying enough to that. We're asking for four meetings after this. We want them to come to the land and see the conditions that the people are living in, because it's dehumanizing, fear, harassment, the overflights, the guns, the war jets flying 20 feet above. The women do not have the right to gather and teach their children weaving in teepees and on the land anymore, and we're standing up for those rights. Tony Serra is my lawyer for protecting the women's rights to run their own business, Weaving for Freedom, that's been going on for 20 years. But today we want to ask people that are working on Wall Street to walk down to the Third World Financial Center on their lunch break. We want everybody to come out to Lehman Brothers, hold vigil outside, because the elders will be inside asking for the demilitarization of their area and protection of their sacred, historic, significant land.
If people want to get in touch with the whole movement, dealing with the issue of Peabody Coal? Where can they call or go on the web?
Well, I think everybody should start with reading Leonard Benally's statements. They can contact weavingfree@hotmail.com and ask for Leonard's statements in the Lehman Brothers Packet press release. They can also, basically, there's a web page. It's www.cyberchicks.com, but there's no C before the K, /weavers. We want to thank you for the time, Amy. You're real important to us, and you're helping the world be a better place.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming into the studio today, and we will continue to follow what comes out of your presence today at the Lehman Brothers shareholders meeting. I'm sorry that Lehman Brothers turned down our invitation to join you on the program. Arlene Hamilton, coordinator of Weaving for Freedom, Leonard Benally, one of the resistors at Big Mountain and organizers of the Lehman Prayer Vigil, Chief Joseph Chasing Horse, Sundance Chief from the Lakota Nation, and Roberta Blackout, one of the Navajo elders, 85 years old, who made the trip to New York to speak to Lehman Brothers and their running of managing the investment fund that's the major owner of Peabody Coal. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by Father Michael Lapsley, ANC priest, who had his hands and eye blown up by an apartheid letter bomb and is now dealing with the issue of reconciliation. Stay with us, and thank you again for being with us. You're listening to Free Speech Radio, Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In 1990, 3 months after the release of Nelson Mandela, the apartheid government sent Father Michael Lapsley a parcel containing two magazines. Inside one of them was a highly sophisticated bomb. When Father Lapsley opened the magazine, the explosion brought down ceilings in the house and blew a hole in the floors, shattering the windows. It also blew off both of his hands, ruined an eye, and burned him severely. While in the hospital, people tried to prepare him for a life of disability, emphasizing all the things he could no longer do. In a speech this December, Father Lapsley said, "My friend phoned me in the hospital bed to say he'd just been visiting Cape Town and heard there were plans to start a center for victims of violence and torture. He told me, 'I think that's a job which you can do. You will be better qualified now.'" Those special qualifications were joined to the experience of years as an anti-apartheid ANC activist and priest. From 1993 to 1998, Father Michael Lapsley was a chaplain to a trauma center for victims of violence and torture. He's now the director of the Institute for Healing of Memories and is in the United States for 1 month to speak about his experiences. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us.
Great to be here on Democracy Now! Yet again. I'm glad Democracy Now! Is still here.
Well, and I'm very glad to have you back in the studios, Father Lapsley. Why don't we start with what you're doing now? I last saw you, I believe, soon after you testified before the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission about your own case.
Well, concerning my own particular case, we still don't know who sent that letter bomb. So in that sense, I have, like many South Africans, unfinished business. But it was important to me to say, I will not be consumed by chasing them. Rather, I will give my life to walking alongside others on the journey towards healing and wholeness. And today that is particularly expressed in this Institute for the Healing of the Memories, where we seek to provide the opportunity for people to deal with the psychological, emotional, and spiritual effects of the country's past on them, which in South Africa, of course, is particularly the apartheid years. We continue to work all over South Africa, but we also increasingly have been asked to come to other countries. So, for example, last year I was briefly in Kosovo. We did a series of workshops in Northern Ireland. And also in East Timor, and somehow it's appropriate that you're having President Shanana Gusmão and Kirsty Sword coming in, because it's just a few months ago in November that I went to Timor Lorosai and led a Healing of Memories workshop in that context. Because history and context and geography, all those things are unique to particular countries. But if you talk about human pain and suffering and hatred and bitterness and hope and faith and courage, this is the story of the human family. And even when a society finally begins to have a political solution, begins to put in place just political structures, you still have to deal with the effect on the individuals of the journey that they have traveled. Because if you don't, victims themselves become victimizers. And we see this particularly in South Africa, where we have an end of political violence, but we have an increase of sexual violence, family violence, domestic violence, because people take the hatred and the bitterness and they continue to express it even in the family. So a key part of our work is, how do you break that chain that makes victims become victimizers? And a key to breaking that chain is giving people the space to deal with what is inside them.
Just to follow up on what you said, tomorrow on Democracy Now! We will have an exclusive interview, be live in the studio with the rebel leader of East Timor, Shanana Gusmão, who is in New York, along with his wife, Kirsty Sword Gusmão, who is a solidarity activist for many years. She's speaking today at Columbia University on the plight of women in East Timor.
Maybe, could I tell you, I met Shanana Gusmão in prison. And we talked while he was in his prison house, just before he came out of prison, and we talked about the future. And he was talking about the importance of reconciliation, of reconstruction and development in a very wonderful way. And I remember saying to him, Comrade Gusmão, your pain, your hurt, your suffering has been acknowledged by the peoples of the world. But the day will have to come where the pain and hurt and suffering of your people is also dealt with, if they are going to be able to move forward to create a different kind of society.
And what form do you think that that has to take? In South Africa, you have the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, though there's a question about whether you think that did go a ways to dealing with that.
Well, I think there are multitudinous ways, individually, community, collectively, that people can come to terms with the past. And I don't think any of us have a monopoly on it. We believe that our own Healing of the Memories workshop is one way, one contribution towards healing and wholeness. You see, there are those who, because of their hurt, need expert psychological or psychiatric intervention. But they are a minority. But there's a vast number of people who are functioning, who are living their lives, who are survivors, but they still carry with them immense pain and hurt, and they need the space to be able to deal with it. Now, referring to South Africa's Truth Commission, I think never before in history has a society put on the table what people did to each other in the same generation and the way that South Africa has done. And that challenges the whole of humanity. However, the Truth Commission made its final report in October of 1998. But then 2 years later, nothing had happened about reparations for those who were declared victims. And we've been engaged in a very in a struggle to persuade the state to honor its commitment to final reparations. A giant step forward was made just recently where our Minister of Finance committed himself to 800 million rands for reparations for final victims, for final reparations for victims.
What about corporations that benefited from the apartheid years, Anglo-American, De Beers?
It's interesting. I was present just a few weeks ago at a meeting between big business and the Truth Commission. I was, in fact, in the dying days of the Truth Commission beginning to wrap up its work. And some parts of big business were willing to come to the party. They were emphasizing how important it was that their reparations should be voluntary. And there happened to be somebody there from the German Chamber of Commerce.
As voluntary as the labor of the men and women in the mines.
Well, yes. Well, the point this German man made was sort of dream on. I mean, how long do we wait for the voluntary reparations? And the fact the Truth Commission itself had recommended to the state that there should be some kind of reparation tax. But I think your point illustrates that there were many beneficiaries of apartheid. In one sense, all white people in South Africa were beneficiaries from apartheid. Even if they opposed it, they were still its beneficiaries. Big business in South Africa, big business internationally, and we know that throughout the Western world there were incredibly significant anti-apartheid movements of the people, but they had to bring immense pressure to bear on their governments before they were willing to bring about reparations. Sorry, before they were willing to become anti-apartheid. In any sense. So throughout the Western world, there are the beneficiaries of apartheid who have a role to play in the reconstruction of South Africa. You see, if we pay reparations fully as recommended by the Truth Commission, what the state has proposed is about a third of what had been recommended by the Truth Commission. But even if that third is fully paid and quickly paid, South Africa's Truth Commission will go down in history as an extraordinary example of restorative justice. If, however, reparations are not paid, then the Truth Commission will go down in history as essentially a perpetrator-friendly exercise. And that would be tragic and sad. But I think there are signs that, in fact, the state is going to honor its obligations. And we're very encouraged by that. Because otherwise, you have a sense that relatives of victims and survivors could be tempted to revenge because all forms of justice would have been removed, because those who get amnesty under the Truth Commission cannot be civilly or criminally prosecuted. But you see, apart from the Truth Commission, something like 23,000 people gave evidence to the Truth Commission. We're a country of 43 million, and I would assert that all of us were damaged by apartheid. We were damaged by what we did, we were damaged by what was done to us, we were damaged by what we failed to do. And while we struggle to reconstruct another kind of country in an ongoing way, we have to deal with the past. We have to deal with the effects on us of the things that we have done. We've got to act politically and economically, but we also have to act psychologically, emotionally, and spiritually.
In your case, the people who sent you the letter bomb, have they been identified at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission? Have they come forward? Because that would make them immune.
Yes, nobody came forward. There was some evidence in one of the hearings in Canberra of somebody who was present at a conversation 3 years before they actually attempted to kill me. And this particular person was arguing against sending me a letter bomb and saying, rather we should send him a parcel bomb. Because if we send a letter bomb, maybe we'll just blow off his hands and you'll haunt us forever. So I guess they were prophetic in their own way. Because I would say, Amy, in many profound ways, I'm a much freer human being than those who did it to me. In that bomb, I lost a lot. I still have a lot. But I've gained a lot. I'm a better human being for the journey that I've traveled. The person who did it to me, either they say so dehumanized they don't care, or they live with their guilt. And I hold the key. And in a way, I hope the day would come that they would come forward and I would be able to liberate them so they too can be free human beings.
Is there anything you can't forgive, Father Lapsley?
Well, you see, I would say in a funny sort of way, forgiveness is not yet on the table for me because there's nobody to forgive. I say I'm not filled with hatred, I'm not bitter, I don't want revenge. But forgiveness is something that waits to come on the table because there has to be somebody to forgive. But if somebody said to me, I sent you that letter bomb, will you forgive me? My first question would be, do you still make letter bombs? They say, no, actually, I work at the local hospital. I would say to that person, of course I forgive you. And I would prefer you spent the next 50 years at that local hospital because I believe in restorative justice rather than retributive justice. I know there's not many people in the United States that can spell restorative justice. You seem to believe rather more deeply in retributive justice, sadly. But I might also say to the person, yes, of course I forgive you. And I would prefer, but I might also say, I will always need someone to help me because of what's happened to me. Of course, you will help pay for that person, and that would be a form of restitution and reparation in the ways that are possible. I feel anger towards the people in our society, particularly the old white political leaders who say, I saw nothing, I knew nothing, I did nothing. Who let themselves off the hook and in a sense shortchanged the white population from facing up to its culpability and complicity.
As we wrap up, and you come to the United States not infrequently, and I'll give the number if people want to get in touch with you here, as you're here in this month conducting seminars and available to speak. What do you say about our country, which is beginning the discussion, though there's been a movement for a long time, about reparations here around the issue of slavery?
I think it's very important to find the ways of moving towards the restoration of justice. Equally incredibly important is the struggle for the moratorium against the death penalty. The United States will become infinitely a more civilized society when it stops killing its own citizens and begins to deal with the effects of the pain and hurt of the past in creative, in constructive ways that will be all win for all sectors of the society of the United States. But I hope also people will look at some of the things on our website, www.healingofmemories.co, and as you say in the United States, ZA, healingofmemories.co.za as a way of looking at some of the kind of work that we are doing around healing of memories. But also for the religious people who listen to your program, I'm going to be at the Church of the Intercession, which I think is 150 what? You've got it in ink on your paper?
Well, they'll have to find it. The
155th, I think, in Broadway.
155th and Broadway.
Yes.
Well,
and also I think Connie Hogarth is the contact person, and you've got the number down there at the bottom
right.
of the page.
You're leading seminars at the Connie Hogarth Center at Manhattanville College in Purchase, New York. And if people want to get in touch with you, they can call 845-838-2415. That's 845-838-2415 and get all contact information on our website at webactive.com.
And thank you, Amy, for helping this program to make the United States a more humane and more just and more compassionate place. I'd say long live Democracy Now!
Well, thank you very much, Father Michael Lapsley. If you'd like to email us, you can write to mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. For a copy of today's show, 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Anthony Sloan's our engineer. Special thanks to Stephen Erickson. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science, as well as issues concerning war, peace, and the environment. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science and politics. Our lead story today is a new skull has been found in Africa that complicates the origins of human evolution. It was Charles Darwin himself who singled out Africa as the birthplace of humanity. However, scientists have just recently found yet a new lineage which could complicate the understanding of human origins. So today on Exploration, we'll say a few things about the evolution of Homo sapiens. And also, scientists have found a new constituent of dark matter.